As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
This is The Athletic Baseball Show on the Athletic Podcast Network.
That is hammered! Oh, my!
Man, that ball got out of here in a hurry. You know, anything travels that far, I'd have a damn stewardess on it, don't you think?
High drive! Left field! It is out of here!
This is a simple game. You throw the ball, you hit the ball, you catch the ball. You got it!
You're listening to The Roundtable with Grant Brisby and Andy McCullough on the Athletic Podcast Network.
Welcome to episode 6 of The Roundtable. I am Grant Brisby. I'm here with Andy McCullough. And today we have a guest. We have a Dodgers beat writer, Fabian Ardaya. Fabian, how are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing well. Let's just jump right into it because the Dodgers are 19-8, but their Pythagorean win loss is 21-6. So what is wrong with the Dodgers this year?
They have to blow it up. I mean, really, this best roster, best lineup ever, it's just not panning out. They're 19-8. Their ERA is only in the low twos. It's just not working.
Yeah, I have a lot of notes, like bullet pointed notes. Number one, tell him to have them cut it out. Number two, what the hell? What's going on with the Dodgers? Why are they so good again?
I just want to point out, that some dumbass wrote for The Athletic last October that last year was the end of Dodgers hegemony in the National League West. So I don't know who it was. I'm not sure. It might have been me, but I can't say for sure.
I forgot about that. Yeah, no, I just wrote for The Athletic. It's a great publication that the Dodgers will never, ever be bad again. And I stand by that. Will they ever be bad again?
I mean, they didn't even win the division last year. So what are we talking about?
I love that they won 106 games in each of the last two full seasons. And the 2020 season, which was truncated, they had an even better winning percentage.
Yeah, that might have been their best team.
Yeah, it's a wild team. What's it like to cover them?
It's a lot of stars, a lot of names that like you just hear about every single day. And you sort of just walk into a clubhouse. It's still kind of jarring, especially now that I'm back in the clubhouse. Just sort of seeing all the different nameplates and all the different things that they've accomplished. They're definitely an interesting club to follow in the fact that like they can have some problems going on with the team. And like they have a lot of guys in their lineup who have not hit. And yet we're talking about them at 19-8, like they're the best team in baseball. Like that's just sort of the gap that they've created for themselves. So in a way, it's kind of challenging in the fact that like we can't really ever write that the sky is falling because the sky is never falling or anything like that.
I was wondering how difficult it is to write about a team where anything less than like a 3-run victory is somewhat surprising because the Dodgers, they're averaging 5 runs a game when the rest of the league is averaging like 0.2 runs a game. Their ERA, like you said, I think it's 2.14 or something like that. They're basically like a Cy Young candidate from 1968 spread throughout an entire pitching staff. Is it tricky to find storylines? Like, I'm just trying to figure out how he would crack that nut of the Dodgers because they're as good as expected and nothing ever changes.
Yeah, I mean, it is tricky in the sense that, like you mentioned, like, the things are going to go well. Like, I wrote about this week just about their offense. Like, they have, like, a 714 OPS this year as a team, but, like, everyone does. And to pair that with a great team or ERA, they're doing fine. Like, they're, relatively speaking, they're always going to be doing pretty well. Makes it easier with some of the stars that they have, just in the fact that, like, you can sort of pinpoint on how different guys are doing, just because, like, those guys are guys that matter at the end of the day. But also, at the end of the day, like, what really matters in terms of the team winning baseball games, it's not going to change that much. It's just about, like, who's going to be the main contributors come October.
It reminds me in some ways of the 2020 group, and I know, like, it's kind of hard to draw any conclusions about that screwed up season, but, like, that team was, like, very clearly the best team in baseball. They had the best record in baseball, and if you watch them, they didn't play particularly well all year. Like, no one had a great, like, individual season for the most part. You know, a lot of guys were sort of, like, middling to average. You know, the lineup never really clicked all at once, but that's the thing when you have nine really good players in your lineup, which they often do, is that you can have seven guys underwater, and when two of the guys who are hitting are Freddie Freeman and Mookie Betts, like, you can win a lot of games given the way that they pitch. And so, like, if you look at how they perform thus far, like, Freeman's having a really good year. Mookie Betts is playing well considering the run scoring environment. And everyone else is like, you're like, what? You know, if everyone else, if you looked at them individually, you're like, ooh, not having a great season here. I mean, Justin Turner, I think, is a bit of an outlier because he is significantly below expectations. But, you know, Cody Bellinger is scuffling again. Chris Taylor is, you know, Trey Turner is a bit not doing what he's supposed to be doing. But, like, they're all so good that on the random days when one of those guys has a nice game, like, it's just a huge benefit. It's just, many people have said that if you assemble a lineup full of all-stars, it is a good thing for your winning percentage, and the Dodgers are proving that baseball truism.
Yeah, we basically had something with Dave Roberts, like, I think it was Friday or Saturday, just basically running through the entire lineup, like, all right, what's going on with this guy, what's going on with this guy, because they're all scuffling, and then they go out and outscore the Cubs 20-3 in three games. Like, it's just one of those things where, like, you can pin down on certain guys, but at the end of the day, it's, you created that buffer.
Justin Turner often starts slow. This is a bit slower than normal. How serious is, you know, I mean, he's got like a 36 OPS plus. How serious is the concern about him right now?
I don't think it's necessarily to the point where they're going to make any changes or anything anytime soon, but they're aware, like, obviously, of how much he's struggling right now. And he's just not being able to get, like, doing the stuff that gets him results. Like, the stuff that gets him results is being able to sort of jump in front of pitches, elevate them, and drive the ball. And he's in a position where, whether it's mechanical, whether it's age, whether it's all this sort of stuff, that he is either, if he's going to do that, he's cheating to the ball or he's late. And that's going to hurt his ability to, one, drive the baseball, and two, that even the occasions where he does get under the baseball, the ball is not going to cooperate, so it's not going to lend the results that he wants. So it's sort of difficult because, like, you could sort of say, oh, he needs to stop trying to lift the ball and go back to a line drive hitter, but then it's just basically the same guy that Andy covered with the Mets. So that's the problem.
The Dodgers template for, I don't know, last decade or so has been to get a wave of players who are underpaid relative to their talents, and to that allows them to subsidize big contracts, whether it's to keep Clayton Kershaw or Kenley Jansen around, or get Zach Greinke. But you would always get, okay, now we've got Justin Turner, he's not making a ton of money, and then, you know, a few years down the road, he will. Cody Bellinger, he's going to give us MVP production for peanuts, and they keep this conveyor belt going. Is there still a conveyor belt going? Because right now they're trying to do this with Gavin Lux. You know, Will Smith is about to get expensive. I'm not seeing that conveyor belt pop out the next Chris Taylor's or Max Muncy's quite right now. What am I missing underneath? Oh, wait, I got Andy's got a finger up.
This is why a genius wrote that the era of Dodgers hegemony is ending.
So is there a pipeline? What is Andy right? Is this it for the Dodgers?
Well, it's something I talked to, like, Friedman and Dave Roberts and stuff about, like, just how long they can keep this going this spring, just because, like, you're right. Like, they got really fortunate, or also were really good in the fact that they were able to get Corey Seager, Cody Bellinger, Julio Rios, Walker Buehler, like, this young crop of superstars on basically the league minimum salary for the first couple of years. They have to keep doing that. Will Smith is probably the best case of, like, best situation of this sort of wave of, like, a guy who hit. But, like, you're still waiting on Gavin Lux to turn a corner, although he has a little bit this year, not to the star level. The next couple waves are, that's sort of what's in the pipeline right now. I know Keith Law is really high on that system, ranked as top one in baseball, but it's not necessarily one that's filled with star power. there obviously are guys who have chances to be stars. Bobby Miller is throwing 102. I think that gives you a good shot at sort of being successful. Ryan Pepiot is probably going to debut this week, and he's a guy who they're really high on. Miguel Vargas can swing the bat. And then obviously the guy that everyone talks about when they talk about the system is Diego Cartaya, who is another catcher. But Cartaya is still a couple years away. Some of the guys like Vargas and Michael Busch and Ryan Pepiot and Bobby Miller are probably the types that will at least be good roster filler, be good productive big league players in the next couple of years. It's just a matter of if those guys turn out to be stars. And if they do, then obviously you're looking at a window that's cracked even wider.
Is Cody Bellinger, is this his level of production? Is it within the spectrum of what we should expect going forward? I don't expect him to be as bad as he was last year ever again, but is he a guy who's going to run into a pitch every so often, but not come anywhere close to all-star level production, if not MVP production?
I don't think anyone knows really what they're going to expect out of Cody Bellinger's production this year. I think that's the problem. Like, you're sort of looking at a guy, obviously, he's not going to have like a 460 OPS or whatever he had last year, because that was just a miserable year where he wasn't healthy and then he tried making up for it and it all spiraled. Is he going to be an MVP again? I don't know. It's hard to really say. And basically with how he's looked so far, not at this point, he's not going to be that type of guy. But like, he's a guy who the talent hasn't eroded in the sense that like, he can still obviously man the outfield incredibly well. When he does connect on a pitch, sometimes he can connect on pitches that few players, if any, can. Like, I look at last year, the home run he hit off Luke Jackson, the NLCS, like a ball like at his eyes. Like, there are very few players who can sort of figure it out just with so much natural talent. It's just about, all right, what type of hitter is he now? And if they can consistently find something that works. I sort of, before the season, looked at like his 2018 season when he was about like an 800 OPS guy, ran into one every once in a while and played really great defense. And that's still like a four war player, or like a really good player. I think that's the type of player that like the median level of Cody Bellinger's career probably will be or could be. But I don't know what it's going to look like this year or next year.
Well, I think the challenge with Bellinger is like, not to get too mathy on you, and it's very possible I'm going to get these terms completely wrong, but I think it's not the median, it's more the mean. And the problem is that like, 1 year he might OPS 900 again, and the next year he might OPS 600 again. And I don't think Dodgers officials, as you know, like, they don't know which one it's going to be year to year. You just have no idea which version of Bellinger is going to show up. I mean, you haven't seen the star level guy in several years. So, but there's no reason that he might not be that guy next year, in his, what would be, I think, his final year of ARB. So like, it's just hard to determine like, what is his value, you know, like to the team moving forward. He's an elite center fielder. He's an elite runner. He's still a good first baseman. Not that they necessarily need that moving forward. Like, he's such a valuable player if he's a remotely decent hitter. It's just which guy is going to show up from year to year. I don't know how you can make a long-term commitment to a player like that given the money he might command elsewhere.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's sort of like why it makes sense, obviously, that they did not tender him. Not that it was ever that serious consideration, but obviously that like the topic came up, just considering that like, obviously you have a guy OPSing 450 who's about to make $17 million. But, I mean, the Dodgers can sort of afford to absorb that contract. They can afford to absorb him in their lineup because they won 106 games with him OPSing 450 last year. And you sort of are betting on the chance that he can do that in a one-year span. But to Andy's point, like, I don't know how teams are going to gauge his market when he hits free agency, just because they don't know what they're going to get on an annual basis. And if you bet big on the year that he OPSs 600, that's a really tough thing to swallow if you're a team that doesn't have the depth that the Dodgers do.
When I think of like a high variance hitter, I think of someone like Javier Baez, someone who is going to strike out 150 times. He's never going to walk, but he'll have these years where he's just in the zone. He's crushing it. Anything down the middle, he's doing what he's supposed to be doing. Or a guy like Josh Hamilton, where you know you're going to have holes in his bat, but he's doing just great things most of the time when you're expecting it. With Bellinger, what drives me nuts about looking at his baseball reference page is that when he was at his best in 19 and 20, he was walking about once for every strikeout. Like, he was not a crazy strikeout hitter. He was not just waving through 40% of his pitches. And so you have proof that he can do that. He was a 23, 24 year old who had the secret of hitting. You saw him, and it wasn't easy to get him out. It wasn't easy to fool him. And now he's still young, still should be in the prime of his career, but he's flipped into one of those Javier Baez in a down year kind of mode where he's just hack, 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 easy to get out. I don't remember seeing a guy in his early to mid 20s just turn from being a plate discipline monster to what he is now.
Yeah, I think part of it is, I think the shoulder stuff has as much of an impact mentally as it does physically for him, in the fact that, like, I'm sure he wants to get back to that guy. He wants to go back to 2019 and even 2020. I think, I'm sure, Andy, you understand this better. You were more around the team during this time than I was. But like 2020, I'm sure he was still trying to chase that high of the first half of 2019, which is why he was fooling around with the stance that winter. There's something of chasing your own success, and that's something that I'm sure he's tried to do. I know he's sort of mentally, at least publicly, tried to talk about, like, all right, it's a different year, I can't go back. Like, I'm not, I don't want to talk about 2019, but I'm sure, obviously, if you have shown that you have an MVP in your sort of trophy case, if you have 47 home runs to your tally in a single season, you kind of want to go back to that. But obviously, like, he's a different player than he was then, and he has to find something that works for him now.
I know Dodgers folks were a bit unnerved when Bellinger showed up in 2020 and said he'd been tinkering with his swing over the winter and was changing it. They're like, no, you should keep doing the thing that made you an MVP last year. But, you know, that's just, and I think that's just going to happen from year to year. He's got a big, there's a lot of moving parts, you know. The plate discipline, that's a weird one, Grant. I don't know the explanation for that. I do feel like he has, and not to become the type of person I hate, but I do think the baseball, like, has some effects, right? In 17 and 19, the ball was as juiced as it has been in recent years, and those were the years where he was really, really good. So he was getting rewarded for hard contact. He's not getting rewarded as much for hard contact, and he's making less of it, you know? So that's a bad combination.
I will say, Fabian, to your point about chasing your own success, every time I publish something, I'm trying to get that feeling of when I wrote, which giant is like which Star Wars character from 2008. I just can't recapture that feeling. So I know it very well. All right, we're going to move on to the surprise teams. Everyone's got to pick a surprise team. And we're going to talk about which teams are making us go jinkies. I wasn't expecting that. Which one of you is so passionate about your surprise team that you're just overflowing and you have to go first?
Fabian should go first because I've already changed my mind on who I think it is.
I've changed my mind a bunch, mostly because I've been burned by the team that, like, immediately comes to mind enough times just because I've been around them. I'll say the Angels. Like, what the heck? It seems like it's been the same sort of plan that they had every single year where, like, you hope you're betting on a few pitchers. You look at this lineup and, like, all right, on paper, this works out really well, except it's actually working this year. I think part of it is obviously they've had they finally have had the complementary pieces on their roster start to click. Like, Taylor Ward, his story and what he's been able to do this year and finally figuring it out at age 28, like, that's a huge boost for the team. Obviously, having Jared Walsh be an all-star last year, having him be that sort of guy, having it so it's sort of like a five or six deep lineup as opposed to, like, you look at this top three and this top three is all great, but everything else is sort of like a black hole. Having that be part of it and having enough good quality starting pitching, having Patrick Sandoval look like he's actually, like, a quality big league starter, that's been all the difference for them so far this year. And, like, they've looked really great. They've been super surprising to me.
They have Taylor Ward, Tyler Wade, and Jared Walsh. Wow, Perry Manasian is a wizard.
When I saw the Angels in the last couple of years, they had one of the greatest head starts in the history of roster building, where you have one of the greatest players of all time, full stop, don't need to adjust for context. Then you have a dude who is a Cy Young and DH monster at the same time, taking one roster spot. You have that, and it's there. And all you have to do is not completely screw up most of the other parts of the roster. And every year, it wouldn't just be this pitcher is doing okay. He's got an ERA in the fours. Every year, there was some explosion you could see from space in the rotation or the bullpen or in the lineup. There are always not just below average players surrounding these guys, but objectively bad players throughout the roster. And this year, they don't have that. And I feel like this should be what they should have been expecting the whole time.
This is sort of like what the game plan always kind of was. So, like, oh, if enough things break right, and if basically the people we expect to be at least like playable are playable. And that wasn't the case in previous years. And I'll give Perunowski credit, like, to be able to cut Albert Pujols loose last year and to be able to cut Justin Upton loose this year before the season, being willing to like cut ties more willingly that with like those sort of situations when they do backfire, I think it sort of opened the door for more and more guys to have the opportunity and figure out at least enough of like how to make their way as big leaguers and be productive enough to sort of elevate the rest of this group. And then having your top three all be healthy. I know Anthony Rendon hasn't swung the bat the way he wanted to, but like having all three of those guys in that lineup, it just makes a difference.
Grant did a whole soliloquy recently about sunk cost fallacy. The theme of this podcast is just what it was like writing about baseball 13 years ago. So it's fun.
It was wild, man. You should have been around the blog days. Remember, we did some shit.
Remember game 162 in 2011, man? That was crazy. Dan Johnson.
Yeah, that was good. Oh, everyone loved my stuff there. All right, Andy, go.
All right. This should not be a surprise. I just want to point out the way this team is playing makes me feel like an idiot because I essentially counted them out. Not counted them out, but didn't really think about them too much in projecting how this season would play out. And that's the Tampa Bay Rays. It's not a surprise that they're, you know, as of right now, 18-12 and in second place. It shouldn't be a surprise, but it surprised me because I'm an idiot. And I forgot that they have a process. They have a way of doing things that very clearly is proven to work. And they also have a really, really, really strong farm system. And they have a lot of good young players. Obviously Wander Franco is a, you know, budding superstar, like a really, really great player. They're getting like great production again out of, all their pitchers, you know, all the young fellas who, you know, JP, like Firehosen and, all the guys you never know. But they got some guy named Jeffrey Springs. No idea.
I'm looking at this roster. It's like Jason. Okay. And then I'll click on it and he's been doing it for like 6 years or so. I don't know.
Like they're getting, Manny Margot is playing really well, right? Like, G-Man Choi is playing really well. Randy Arozarena is going to come back and be more productive. You know, they're getting a good another season out of Yandy Diaz. Like they know how to leverage their players. They use them optimally. They have guys bought in. I think the Yankees are better, and I do think the Blue Jays are really good, but I sort of looked at it as kind of a two-team race in the East between the Yankees and the Blue Jays, and I slept on the Rays, and it's like one of those things you just already feel stupid about.
One of my good friends from the old blogging days, Jeff Sullivan, works for the Rays, and I have to think that his official title is something like Director of Finding Relief Weirdos, because that's what he was really good at when he was writing for Fangraphs. It's just, I've noticed this guy throws a sinker with his teeth, or like, I don't know, like he would always find these guys and break down the clips. And it feels like the success of the Rays is tethered to this idea that they're going to just go into a burlap sack and pull out Jeffrey Springs and go, here's 60 innings of 2 ERA baseball, or here's Jason Adam, here's Ryan Thompson, and nothing else necessarily matters. I mean, it does. Corey Kluber's having a great bounce back year, and they're getting good stuff from starting pitchers like Drew Rasmussen. This idea that you are looking for 1,500 innings of quality pitching rather than here are my five guys. I want 1,000 innings out of these five at the top. And then I want, a good 80 innings from this closer. And I want, it's just figure out how you're going to get 1,500 really good competitive innings. And the Rays are as good as any team, if not better, at just finding those 1,500 innings.
There was this great book called Moneyball, where this team called the Oakland A's was trying to replace Jason Giambi. And he had like a 450 OBP, but they were also losing three other players, and the three of them combined had like a 330 OBP, and they needed to find three players with an OBP above 330. And as everyone knows, the A's won the World Series that year. It's a great story.
The lesson of that book was that you just don't need to find starting pitching. The A's were good in that era, even though they had no one as a good starting pitcher.
And you don't need a good shortstop either.
Right, yeah. They didn't really have a good shortstop. It's a fantastic sum is greater than the parts.
It is crazy. Grant, like when you lay it out like that, right, where it's like, okay, we have 1,500 innings, right? Like, that we need to cover. Okay, how do we cover that, right? Like, it's when you're building a game plan for one baseball game. We have 27 outs. How are we going to cover that? What's the optimal way to do that? And, like, the configurations that you can get to that point, right? You can do them traditionally. You can do them sort of absurdly. But, like, it really is just kind of like a math problem in some ways. And I think the easiest way to solve it is to have, you know, five starters who can throw 200 innings. But, like, those players don't exist anymore. So what's the cheaper, more efficient way to do it? Well, you see what the Rays do. And, like, I wrote a whole thing about this last year. Like, is it good for the future of the sport that they are so good at this that they're clearly providing a blueprint for how to do it? Probably not. But, like, what do they owe the sport? They're trying to win based on the parameters set forth by their owner. And, like, you can dislike the way that, you know, they conduct them, you know, the way that they've conducted themselves in the past in arbitration, right? Like, they were the team that always tried to win the belt for, you know, winning arb cases or whatever. You can dislike the fact that, you know, they're sort of messing with this, you know, the city of St. Pete, and there's all the stadium things, right? There's lots of things, right, that if you're, like, someone who wants to get mad about this stuff, like, you can. But at the same time, like, they're really good. Like, year after year after year, they play in a very tough division. Like, what more do they owe their fans other than trying to put together a team that can win the World Series, I guess?
They should not be concerned with the aesthetics of baseball. Yeah.
I mean, but maybe they should. I don't know. Like, I go back and forth on this, right?
Here's the thing. Like, if I'm rooting for a sports team, I care about them winning more than how they look.
I think so, too. I think so, too, to be clear. Yeah.
We'll be right back after a quick word from our sponsors. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
When you get injured, you don't want to wait for answers and options. That's why it may be time to explore the Nano Experience, a revolutionary treatment option designed to help active people get back to the lifestyles they love. Nanotechnology allows surgeons to see inside even the smallest joints and treat orthopedic conditions with a tiny camera and other nano instrumentation, all through a barely there poke hole incision. Wherever you've experienced an injury, whether it be a foot and ankle, hand and wrist, shoulder and elbow, knee or hip, nanoarthroscopy can be used to diagnose and treat your condition in an extremely, minimally invasive way. Don't wait to learn about the revolutionary Nano Experience and how it could help you or someone you know after an injury. Visit arthrex.info/theathletic. This is not medical advice and is not meant to be a substitute for advice from your physician. Talk with your physician about your health condition, potential surgical risks, and whether Arthrex products are right for you. Postoperative management is patient-specific and dependent upon your physician's assessment. Individual results will vary.
If you're as obsessed with basketball as I am, then you know there's no better time of year than the NBA playoffs. Hey guys, this is JJ Redick. Twice a week, I'm cooking up something special for basketball junkies on my podcast, The Old Man and the Three. I bring on guests in all stages of their careers to talk about the league and share stories you won't hear anywhere else, like Devin Booker on why he talks so much trash, or Paolo Banchero on his shooting workouts with Kevin Durant, Ray Allen's epic free throw competitions with LeBron when they were teammates in Miami. But it's not just about the player interviews. Every Monday, I break down the top three things happening around the NBA without the outlandish takes. Often joined by masterminds of the game like Tim Legler, we dive deep into topics like rookie reports, trade breakdowns, and why is meme mugging now a tech? The Old Man and the Three is the only companion podcast you'll need during the playoffs this year. Be sure to listen to The Old Man and the Three ad-free on Wondery Plus or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, I'm going to go the Twins because I don't think of the Twins that often. And just I check in with them and, oh, they're winning 100 games. Wow, that's pretty cool. Oh, you know, they're fantastic. They're in the shortened season. They're a factor in this whole postseason scrum. And then last year, oh, I guess they're terrible last year. And they finished not strong, but they won about, they're about a 500 team for the last couple months of the season. But the way they were bad last year, they could have been much worse. Nelson Cruz, when he was on the Jose Barrios doing good things when he made 20 starts for them, they had things going for them last year and they were still awful. And so even though they had Carlos Correa, that's an amazing coup that they were able to sign Carlos Correa for what they did. They sort of rebuilt their rotation on the fly. I was not giving them any credit. I just figured whatever made them bad last year was going to continue making them bad this year. And they're good. Like, they're not just good in that sort of sneaky, oh, we overplayed or we played over our heads in the first month plus of the season. They're outscoring their opponents by a whole bunch. It's not like Carlos Correa is putting them on his shoulders. He's having a middling sort of year. It's just a collective effort. Joe Ryan is apparently a dude now. Chris Archer is doing what he, you know, he hasn't been healthy for years. Sonny Gray. It's a good looking team.
You're doing the Michael Lewis thing.
What's that?
You're doing the Michael Lewis.
Where thing. I'm ignoring the pitching?
Byron Buxton is slugging 700.
Yeah, I was going to come to that because it's okay. It's sort of like he's the one thing that makes me skeptical because I just look at how he's doing it and he's that all or nothing player right now that we were talking about earlier with Javi Baez where when's that other shoe going to drop? Other than that, though, I'm impressed by the Twins more than I thought I'd be.
The thing is, the Buxton's shoe to drop is the health more than it is production because like he's been this guy when he's stayed healthy. So as long as they keep healthy, I feel like you feel pretty certain about what you're going to get.
Like Correa has on several occasions said, like, he's the best player in baseball. And like, that might be true. Like he's incredible. It's just, you know, he can't stay healthy. So if they could get 140 games of him, you know, with like a 460 WOBA or whatever he's doing right now, like playing, you know, like plus center field, like, yeah, like I would bet on them to, you know, win the division, especially since the White Sox appear to just have the evil on them at this point. Like the White Sox have caught some sort of disease that is just like it's they look ill, basically. I don't know if you saw the game last night, but like they just look like cursed.
A general malaise.
Yeah, and they're not even my most disappointing team because I think that was always a possibility, you know, with that group. But yeah, like I think you look at the Twins and it's sort of like they built up a team that is good enough that if they can get elite production from their cornerstone superstar, they can be a legit contender. I don't know if they have the pitching to really, you know, put the fear of God into anyone really in October. But then again, like, you know, I don't know if the Braves did last year. I mean, they had good pitching, but no one, you know, so who knows? Who knows anymore?
To that point, I feel like the Twins for like a couple of years now, it seems like every single move they've made is like, oh, okay, that makes sense. That looks like a good move. And like, I feel like they've collected enough of those where like they're just a really solid, good team that obviously has enough superstars that if they play like superstars, if Correa is like postseason Correa and Buxton can stay healthy, all of a sudden your ceiling goes up. Like they've made enough like where like, they have just a lot of good baseball players, which is, I think, a good way to build a baseball team.
Before we move on to the most disappointing teams, I'm just going to get you both on record. Do they win one postseason game this year at minimum? I want everyone on record. I think they win at least one postseason game. That's my lock of the week.
If you're a wild card, what does that get you?
Yeah, you're in the full-headed playoffs for the most part.
All right, I'll give them a game. Yeah, they'll win a game.
Yeah, I think it's time. I think it's time.
It'd be the most cursed thing if they get a wild card series against like the Mariners and Mariners finally get there. And
it'd be them winning their division and just getting like boat raced by the Yankees yet again, like in the first round.
But we've seen that before.
That's what's so incredible about it is like there's really no exploit. Like the players are completely different. It's just every time they're both in the postseason, the Yankees just sweep the Twins.
All right, let's move on to the most disappointing teams. These are the teams that we had, I don't know about high hopes, not abjectly terrible teams that are maybe that bad. So who are your disappointing teams? Let's go. Let's flip it and start with Andy this time.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Royals really come to mind. You know, not that they were expected to particularly be incredible this year, but they are getting to a point where you really need to start seeing results from their rebuilding effort. And, you know, they banked a lot, like a lot, pretty much, you know, the future of the rebuilding effort on these guys they drafted in 2018, you know, in the draft. Their first four picks were all college pitchers, and they managed to get them all up to the majors. And these guys have just not really been able to do it. They haven't been the guys that they were hoping them to be, you know. So, you know, Brady Singer and Jackson Coar are back down in the minors. You know, Chris Bubik has like a 13 ERA. You know, Daniel Lynch has been the best of the bunch. He's got a four. You can see sort of the contours of like what the next great Royals team will look like in theory, but it's just not coming together. And, you know, Bobby Witt Jr. is, you know, 22 years old and not playing particularly well, which is, you know, it's like, okay, he's 22. He shouldn't be asked to, you know, carry a franchise. But they just don't, they haven't, you know, Salvador Perez is, you know, has like a 240 OBP. You know, Whit Merrifield is just really not hitting. It's sort of, you know, remarkable how little he's hitting, actually. It's tough. I mean, it's been a long time since they were good. They have invested, you know, a lot of time in building up this core of guys since they, you know, elected to kind of like reset after 2017, and it's just not coming together. It's still early, you know, a lot could change, but there's just not, it's tough. It's tough because they've invested a lot in this group, and it's not going particularly well.
I will say that if you are forced to watch a team like this, I do appreciate that they threw their fans a bone with Zach Greinke, and he's been fantastic over six starts. He has struck out 10 of the 134 batters he's faced. He's like, that's like Jim Palmer in 1970, you know, like it's like a weird anachronism of just, he's not missing bats at all. He's just pure guile and spirit. And by gum, that sounds like a lot of fun to watch.
There's a lot to like with Greinke specifically. You know, you wonder if he's like doing that on purpose. And they have spent money over the years. You know, they haven't, obviously they haven't gotten any big time free agents, but it's not like they're doing what the, you know, the Orioles have done where they've, you know, just sort of completely torn down. They got Zach Greinke. They got Mike Minor a couple years ago. You know, they've got Carlos Santana. They just haven't hit on any of those guys outside of Greinke. You know, Andrew Benintendi's been pretty good, but it's already like, okay, what's the trade value going to be for him potentially in the summer? It's just not coming together, and it's disappointing, I think, for a lot of folks who you know, had hoped that the team kind of could do the rebuild again. I mean, the initial process was very painstaking, you know, long-term project, but it led to two pennants in a World Series. And they were a pretty competitive team the 2 years after that, although they didn't make the playoffs. But it's just, this one is just, it's just not coming together. You know, it's hard to kind of see how it does if these pitchers just remain off track.
That's the problem with teardowns, because like sometimes they just don't work or they take forever to work. And that's the problem with like tearing it down. Like, I don't know, like there are a couple of teams, I think my disappointing team is a perfect example of that too.
Oh, that's a good tease. So have at it. Who is your disappointment? Is it the Dodgers? Because again, they're two games under their Pythagorean.
Roberts on the hot seat?
No. I don't want to be like the 200th person to crap on the Reds, so I won't do that. But I mean, it's probably the Phillies, right? Like it just seems like they've done just like all the things that you sort of would want them to do. They've spent money. They've tried to like really invest in a lineup that looked really scary on paper. You have a couple really good starters. Zach Wheeler could have won Cy Young last year. Aaron Nola's solid, but it just hasn't worked. They haven't been able to develop guys in the way they wanted to, although I know they've revamped their player development, but like it just hasn't worked. And I know this year you built this lineup and everyone kind of knew that they wouldn't be able to defend, but like the extent to which they aren't able to play defense is troubling, and some of the same problems are still the same problems. Like I think the more concerning thing for them is like the Braves haven't gotten going yet, and the Mets are playing great, like, and the Marlins are playing like decent enough. Like, I don't know if they have enough room to like climb out of where the NL East is, outside of like obviously the fact that there's an extra wild card spot, but still, like, they've been rebuilding for essentially a decade at this point, and like they still, like, this is the best that they've been able to manage out of it.
The thing that gets me about the Phillies is that I don't know if it's systemic or if it's just a string of rotten luck. Their bullpen every year is an adventure. And well, what do you do about that? Do you go out and sign the most expensive free agents? Because we know that doesn't work. Do you trade for guys who are at the top of their game? Because we know that that doesn't always work. It seems like a team should have cycles of boom and bust with their bullpen, but there should always be a boom mixed in. There should always be some guy like, oh, this guy's throwing 100 in the minors. We're not sure what to do with him. Let's throw him in. Wow, it worked. And or this left-hander, we're going to claim him on waivers. And wow, he's missing more bats than we thought. The Phillies don't ever seem to stumble into a good bullpen. And I feel like even the worst teams, the Orioles, the Pirates, I don't know, have these moments where they stumble into a good bullpen. And the Phillies haven't even done that yet.
Yeah, but the good teams do have good bullpens. They don't have the same people in them. That's a crucial part. It's always just like, oh, that guy's Phil Bickford. Oh, okay. Wow. I hadn't thought about that guy in 4 years. You know, but like the Dodgers generally have a good bullpen, right? The Yankees.
The Rays, yeah.
The Yankees, the Rays, right? The Giants under Farhan Zaidi are doing that. You know, like the elite teams tend to have processes in place. Now, like what those processes are, I'll never understand because like it's all just, you know, it's all so ridiculous. Like if you are a person who writes about baseball and you understand how to build a bullpen, you will not be writing about baseball for very long. You will be working for a baseball team because they need the help, right? But the elite teams know how to do this. And the Phillies just, you know, whatever regime it is, you know, now it's Dave Dombrowski, like have not had that. And Dombrowski, while he has a lot of, you know, positive qualities and has had obviously a close to a Hall of Fame resume as an executive, has not really been known in his recent years for a guy who can build a bullpen on the fly. So they kind of threw some money at the problem and tried to kind of do it that way. And then it's like, oh, you got, you know, Brad Hand and Corey Knebel and Jurys Familia. And it's like, I don't know, man. They could be good and they could be terrible. You know, who knows?
Yeah, I mean, the Phillies could absolutely figure it out. Like, they could find a guy or two in that walks in that bullpen, and then all of a sudden you're looking at lineup that once it's hitting well and once you sort of have this rotation really locking into place, like you could see the pieces of why people were high on this team, why I thought they were gonna be not necessarily contending for the division because I thought that'd be kind of Braves and Mets, but I thought they'd be pretty much a lock to make a wild card spot or close to it, but it just hasn't panned out so far.
You are younger than us by about 30 years. So when we're talking about the great blogging escapades of 2011 or whatever, this is going to be a generational gap. When I say the words Sam Fold Wikipedia page, do you have any idea what I'm talking about?
I know it's extensively long, mostly just because I've heard other people talking about it. So I found myself doing that. And also I spoke to Sam Fold for like a story this winter just because he played with Brandon Gomes, the new Dodgers GM, and stuff like that. So I briefly opened it up and I actually got to experience it for the first time. And wow,
okay.
That's okay. An extensive one.
Yeah, no, it's just that it captivated the internet. I don't even know if it was a Twitter thing or what, but it became like this meme for about a month where everyone's just, it's just delicately footnoted. I'm on the right now. We have 197 footnotes to Sam Fold's Wikipedia page. This is before he was a GM. So I'm just proud it keeps going. Were you aware of it, Andy?
Yeah, I hadn't thought about this in so long. What was wrong with us?
It was a simpler, more innocent
time. No,
I
think we ruined baseball, actually. I don't think it was the owners. I think it was the writers.
Yeah, no, I'll wear that. I'll wear that. All right. I'm going to move on to my surprising team just because, oh boy. So the Royals have 13 home runs, which is not good.
Not enough.
In 26 games. There is one team that has fewer home runs, surprisingly. The Detroit Tigers have 11 home runs in 28 games. I was promised a half-decent, watchable Tigers team. This is why they signed Eduardo Rodriguez. This is why they signed Baez. And at the time, people were thinking, okay, yeah, you know, it's about time to get into that pool and start seeing what you have with the talent that you have. And I was expecting watchable Tigers. They are emphatically unwatchable.
They came to Los Angeles, like, last month, and I looked at like the lineup sheet. It's like, all right, like, there's enough, like, I've seen Robbie Grossman be good. Like, Javi Baez is a good player. Miguel Cabrera, like, he's not what he used to be, but he still, like, puts together good at-bats. And, like, Spencer Torkelson's exciting. I've seen him since college. But, like, it was so easy how the Dodgers mowed him down. I know the Dodgers do that to a lot of teams, but, like, it just didn't seem all that competitive for a lot of it.
you know, they had a terrible first month last year, and then they played like either 500 or above 500 for most of the season, right? And it was sort of like a new era of competence. You know, AJ Hinch is the manager. You know, Detroit should be used to spend like a big market team, right? Like when Dave Dombrowski was in charge and they had a bunch of superstars there. Like you look under the hood at like who the lineup is actually built around, and there's a lot of guys who are like, is that guy good? Like, is Jaime Candelario like good? You know, like Akil Baddoo was a wonderful story last year, like a wonderful story, and like it was really fun to watch him play. But like betting on him long term as a Rule 5 guy, that's just that's tough. You know, that's tough. Like Jonathan Scope is an average ish hitter, sometimes slightly above, sometimes slightly below. This year he's way below. And, you know, you're getting, like, it's just, you know, Robbie Grossman, yeah, has been perfectly fine in his career, but there's no real stars in the lineup. And the pitching is just not performing. You know, they have another, like, a bunch of, you know, top picks who have just not exactly worked out. That's tough. I mean, like, when you take guys 1-1 and they're not, you know, like, dominating in the majors a few years later, like, that's tough to deal with, you know?
I feel like when I think of the Tigers and free agents, I always go back to the free agents when they were just really awful in 2004, 2005. Obviously, 2003 was the 119 loss team. And they signed Pudge Rodriguez. They signed the Magly Ordóñez. And at the time, people were saying, oh, why are they doing this? This is a terrible team. Idiots throwing their money away. And it taught me the lesson of, get these players, get them in the clubhouse, get these veterans that you know what they're going to do. They're Hall of Fame or Hall of Fame adjacent kind of players when they're in their prime, and build around them. And maybe you'll build a good team and be very happy you had those players. So when the Tigers this time around signed Rodriguez and Baez, it made perfect sense in that context. Get them. If you build around them, you might have something, maybe not this year, but maybe next year, or maybe this year. Maybe this is the year you challenge the White Sox. If they could undo the Baez deal, if they could undo the Rodriguez deal after a month, do you think that they would pull that lever again? It's a tricky proposition.
I'll never totally understand why they jumped so soon on Baez when Carlos Correa was still available. I mean, I understand the basic economics of it, right? That like Correa was at the time probably asking for twice, if not more than twice, what it costs to get Baez. And yeah, sure, in the actuarial tables, he's not 2x the player than Javier Baez is, but he's, I think, a significantly better player and a significantly more consistent hitter. And, you know, even if he hasn't been playing up to his potential this year thus far. And I think that it just made so much sense that it was really kind of, from my perspective, you know, shocking to see them basically fill that spot up with a player who's perfectly fine. You know, Baez is a good player and he can be very exciting, but he's just not an offensive centerpiece in the way that Carlos Correa can be. I don't know if they would unwind the Baez deal because he's not really the problem. He's hitting about league average. He's a good defender, all that stuff. But I didn't get it outside of like, oh, he's, you know, because it's not like they got him for cheap. He's still really expensive, right? Like, so whatever. I don't know. I don't understand baseball a lot of the time.
It's hard to like envision how the Tigers, with how they sort of like view themselves and are willing to allow themselves to spend, could have done better this winter. But I don't disagree with Andy's point. Like, all right, like this is what they did. It makes sense. Like, there's reasons to feel high about them. But like, it also just like the players that they're choosing to build around, they still are missing like a star. They're still missing that piece to build around, and maybe Riley Green is that person, maybe Spencer Torkelson winds up being that person, but like they still are going to need that for them to really turn this rebuild into something that actually is competitive.
With Rodriguez too, like I think sometimes like when we see a player who has been good in the past get a bunch of money in the winter, we kind of like try and figure out why. Exactly. And so if you look at Rodriguez, you're like, oh, well, this guy, you know, like in 2018, 2019, like he's a, you know, real like number three type starter. And you kind of have to ignore like he didn't pitch in 2020 because he was dealing with, you know, COVID issues and was out the entire season. He was not particularly good in 2021, at least in terms of like preventing runs. So it's not that surprising that a year older, he's not particularly good. Like he hasn't been a good pitcher for many years. Like it's not his fault per se. It's just, it's like when we see players get lots of money, we try and figure out why. And so it's like, oh, you know, like the Giants signed like Alex Cobb. The Giants are really smart. Alex Cobb throws 97 now. And it's like, right, he still has like a 4.5 ERA, which is kind of the guy he's been for a long time. I don't know. I think sometimes we as writers try and justify what the teams are doing when on the face of it, you're like, what? That doesn't make any sense.
All right. This has been episode 6 of the Roundtable. Andy, I saw you had a cat in your lap. Did that cat stay there the whole time?
No. He's in and out. I'm gonna have a talking to with him though. He's getting on my nerves.
Can I tell you, I've done this whole podcast with this puppy.
Oh, wow.
Just eating my finger. Like, you see, it's just this whole thing is just, I've been putting my finger in its mouth for about 40 minutes. That's like nice. A pacifier, just so it didn't bark. So if you ever wonder who the consummate professional is, it's me. All right. So this has been episode 6 of the Roundtable. Fabian Ardaya, thank you so much for coming on. It was a pleasure. We will be back next week and we will talk about baseball. Thanks so much for listening.